Hi, I'm Stephen Cass, a senior editor at IEEE Spectrum, and welcome to Fixing the Future, our bi-weekly podcast that focuses on concrete solutions to hard problems. Before we start, I want to tell you that you can get the latest coverage from some of Spectrum's most important beats, including AI, climate change, and robotics, by signing up for one of our free newsletters. Just go to spectrum.iee.org/newsletters to subscribe. Today on Fixing the Future, we're doing something a little different. Normally, we deep dive into exploring one topic, but that does mean that some really interesting things get left out for the podcast simply because they wouldn't take up a whole episode. So here today to talk about some of those interesting things, I have Spectrum's editor-in-chief, Harry Goldstein. Hi, boss. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Stephen. Happy to be here.
You look thrilled.
I mean, I am thrilled. I'm always excited to talk about Spectrum stories.
No, we've tied you down and made you agree to this, but I think it'll be fun. So first up, I'd like to talk about this guest post we had from Bert Hubert, which seemed to really strike a chord with readers. It was called Why Bloat is Still Software's Biggest Vulnerability, a 2024 Plea for Lean Software. Why do you think this one resonated with readers, and why is it so important?
I think it resonated with readers because software is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. The entire world is essentially run on software. A few days ago, even, there was a good example of the AT&T network going down, likely because of some kind of software misconfiguration. This happens constantly. In fact, it's kind of like bad weather. The software system's going down. It's like you just come to expect it and we all live with it. But why we live with it and why we're forced to live with it is something that people are interested in finding out more, mm-hmm. I guess.
So I think in the past, you know, when we associated giant bloated software, we had associated with like large projects, you know, these big government projects, these big airline, big projects. And we've written about that a lot about Spectrum in the past before, haven't we?
We certainly have. And, you know, Bob Charette, our longtime contributing editor, who is actually the father of lean software. He, back in the early 90s, took the Toyota Total Quality Management program and applied it to software development. Mm. It was pretty interesting to see Hubert's a piece on this more than 30 years later, where the problems have just proliferated. And you know, think about your average car these days. It's approaching a couple hundred million lines of code. A glitch in any of those could cause some kind of safety problem. Recalls are pretty common. I think Toyota had one a few months ago. So it's the problem is everywhere, and it's just going to get worse.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me was that Bert is making the argument that you don't actually need now an army of programmers to create bloated software to get all those millions of lines of code. You could be just writing, the example he gives, writing a very simple a code to open a garage door. This is a trivial program. Because of the way you're writing it on frameworks and those are pulling in dependencies and so on, you're just pulling in just millions of lines of other people's code. You might not even know you're doing it, and you kind of don't notice unless at the end of the day you look at your final program file and you're like, oh, why is that, you know, megabytes upon megabytes, which represents endless lines of source code. Why is that so big? Because we're kind of, this is how you do software. You just pull these things together. You write your glue stuff. You focus on the business logic because that's your value add. But you're not paying attention to this enormous sort of, I don't know, what would you call it? Invisible dark matter that surrounds
right.
your software?
It's kind of like dark matter. Yeah, that's kind of true. It's this... I mean, it actually started making me think, like, all of these large language models that are being applied to software development, co-piloting, I guess they call it, right? Mm-hmm. Where the coder is sitting with an AI trying to write better code. I wonder if that, do you think that might solve the problem or get us
Because I think those systems, if you look at them, they reflect modern programming usage. And modern programming usage is often to use the frameworks that are available. It's not about really getting in and writing something that's a little bit leaner. Actually, I think the AIs, it's not their fault. They just do what we do, and we write bloaty software. So I think that's not going to get any better necessarily with this AI stuff, because the point of lean software is it does take extra time to make, and it's just completely, there are no incentives to make lean software. And Bert talks about maybe we're going to have to impose some of this legislatively. I speak good, I editor, you hire wise. But we're going to, some of these things are going to have to be mandated through standards or regulations in terms of these, and specifically through the lens of these cybersecurity requirements and knowing what's going into your software. And that may help us all just get a little bit leaner. But I did actually want to tell you, you mentioned another news story that came up this week was Apple closing down its EV division. And you mentioned Bob Charette there, and he wrote this great thing for us recently about why EV cars are one thing and EV infrastructure is an even bigger problem. And why EVs are proving to be really, really quite tough, and maybe the problem, again, it's a dark matter problem. Not so much the thing, the car at the center, but this sort of infrastructure surround. Can you just talk a little bit about Bob's book, which is, by the way, free to download, and we'll have the link in the show notes.
The EV, everything you need to know about the EV transition can be yours for the low, low price of free. I think we're starting to see, even if you mandate things, you were talking about legislation to regulate software bloat.
It's a kind of indirect, if you want to have good security, then you're going to have to do certain things. And the White House just came out with this paper, I think yesterday or the day before, saying, okay, you need to start using memory safe languages. And it's not quite saying we will, if you use, you are forbidden from using C and you must use Rust, but it's kind of close to that for certain applications. They exempted certain areas. But you can see that is the government really coming in, and actually what has often been a very personal decision of programmers, what language do I use? And I know how to use C, I know how to do garbage collection, and the government kind of going saying, yeah, we don't care how great a programmer you think you are. These programs lead to this class of bugs, and we'd really prefer if we used one of these memory safe languages. And that's a push into sort of the private lives of programmers. But I think we're going to see more of as time goes by.
Oh, that's interesting. Because where I was going with that connection to legislation is that I think what Bob found in the EV transition is that the knowledge base of the people who are charged with making decisions about regulations is pretty small. They don't really understand the technology. They certainly don't understand the interdependencies, which are very similar to the software development processes you were just referring to. It's very similar to the infrastructure for electric cars, because the idea ultimately, but it's for electric cars, is that you also are revamping your grid to facilitate renewable energy, intermittent renewable energy sources like wind and solar, because having an electric car that runs off a coal-fired power plant is defeating the purpose, essentially. In fact, we had a Ozzie Zehner wrote an article for us way back in the mid-teens about the dirty secret behind your electric car is the coal that fuels it.
That was quite controversial. I think maybe because the cover was, what was it? It was a car person talking of a giant mountain of coal.
True. Yeah. I mean, in China, they have one of the biggest electric car industries in the world, if not the biggest, and one of the biggest markets that has not been totally saturated by personal vehicles. And all their cars are going to be running on coal. And they're the world's second largest emitter behind us, the U.S. So, but, you know, like just circling back to the legislative angle and the state of the electric vehicle industry. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, are we just getting way off topic with the...
No, I do. It is this idea of interdependence and these very... you know, systems that are all coupled in all kinds of ways we don't expect. And just with that EV story, so last time I was home in Ireland, one of the stories was, so they had bought this fleet of buses to put in Dublin or places, double-decker buses, electric double-decker, to, you know, help Ireland hit its carbon target. So this was an official government goal. We bought the buses, great expense, produces the buses, and then they can't charge the buses because they haven't already done the planning permission to get the charging stations added into the bus depot, which just was this like staggering level of interconnect. Whereas one hand, the national government is very, yes, we have meeting our target goals. We're getting these green buses in. It'll be, you know, fantastic advance, very proud of it, la, 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 la. And you can't plug the things in because somebody, just the basic work on the ground and dealing with the local government has not been there to put in the charging stations. It's like all of these right. little disconnects add up. And the bigger, the more complex system you have, the more these things add up, which I think does come back to lean software, because it's not so much, okay, yeah, your software is bloaty. Okay, you don't win the Turing Prize. Ooh. Okay, but the problem is that because you are pulling all these dependencies that you just do not know, and all these places where things break, or the problem of like libraries getting hijacked, you just don't. So we have to retain the capacity on some level, and this actually is a personal thing with me, is that I believe in the concept of personal computing, and this is the thing back in the 1970s that personal computers first came out, which was the idea was you would, it was very explicitly part of the culture that you would free yourself from, you know, the utilities and the centralized systems. And you could have a computer on your desk that will let you do stuff that you didn't have to go through at that stage, you know, university administrators and paperwork. And it was a personal computer revolution. It was very much front and center. And nowadays, it's kind of come back full circle, because now we're increasingly finding things don't work if they're not network connected. And so I believe it should be possible to have machines that operate independently, truly personal machines. I believe it should be possible to write software to do even complicated things without relying on network servers or vast downloads, or, you know, again, the situation where you want it to run independently, okay, but you've got to download, you know, these Docker images that are 350 megabytes or something, because an entire operating system has to be bundled into them, because it is impossible to otherwise like replicate the correct environment in which software is running, which also undercuts the whole point of open source software. The point of open source is like, if I don't like something, I can change it. But if it's so hard for me to change something because I have to replicate the exact environment and tool chains that people on a particular project are using, it really limits the ability of me to come in and maybe I just want to make some small changes, or I just want to modify something, or I want to pull it into my project, that I have to bring this whole trail of dependencies with me.
Right.
Is really tough.
Yeah, I thought Sorry, actually one of the things I learned the most about from the Hubert piece was Docker, and the idea that you have to put your program in a container that carries with it like an entire operating system or whatever.
So it depends. I mean, you can put whatever you want into a container, but sometimes, and some containers are very small. He distributes his own thing. You can get very lean containers that is just basically the program of the install. But it basically replaces the old idea of like installing software, where that was a problem, because every time you installed a bit of software, it scarred your system in some way. There was always scar tissue, because it made changes. It nestled in. It put files onto your, if nothing else, it put files onto your disk. And so over time, you know, the problem was, one of the problems was that this then meant that your computer would accumulate random files. It was very hard to really completely uninstall something completely, because we'd always put little hooks and it would register itself in a different place in the operating system. Again, because now it's interoperating with a whole bunch of stuff. Programs are not completely standalone. They are, at the very least, they're talking to an operating system. You want it to talk nicely to other programs in the operating system. And this led to all these kind of like direct install problems. And so the idea was, oh, we'll sandbox this out. We'll have these like little Docker images basically to do it. But that does give you the freedom whereby you can build these huge images, which are essentially, you know, virtual machines running mm-hmm. away. And so, it relieves the process of having to figure out your install and your configuration, which is, you know, one thing you were talking about, like when you had to do these installers, it did really make you clarify your thinking very sharply on configuration and so on. So, containers are great. All these technologies, cloud technologies, running things like being able to use libraries, being able to automatically pull in dependencies, they're all terrific in moderation. They all solve very real problems. I don't want to be like a Luddite and go, we should go back to writing, you know, assembler code as God intended. And, you know, that's not what I'm saying. Like, it does sometimes enable bad habits. It can incentivize bad habits, and you have to really then think very deliberately about how to combat those problems as they pop up.
But from the beginning, right? Because you have to it seems to me like you have to commit to a lean methodology at the start of any project. It's not something that the AI is going to come in and magically solve and slim down.
I agree. Yeah, you do have to commit to it, or you have to commit to frameworks where I'm not going to use these frameworks. I'm going to go and try and do some of this myself, or I'm going to be very careful in how I look at my frameworks, and that all like what libraries are going to use. And I'm going to use like some of the, maybe a library that doesn't pull in other dependencies. This guy maybe wrote this library which has got 80% of what I need it to do. It does, but it doesn't pull in libraries, unlike the bells and whistles thing, which actually does 400% of what I needed to do. And I'm going maybe I might write that extra 20%. And that, again, it requires skill and it requires time. And you know, it's like anything else. There are just incentives in the world that really tend to sort of militate against having the time to do that, which again is where we start coming back into some of these regulatory regimes where it becomes a compliance requirement. And I think, you know, a lot of people listening will know that time when things gets done is when things become compliance requirements, and then it's mandatory, and that has its own set of issues with it in terms of, you know, losing a certain amount of flexibility and so on. But that often sometimes seems to be the only way to get things done in commercial environments, certainly not in terms of personal projects, but certainly for commercial environments.
Well, and so what are the consequences in a commercial environment of bloat? Besides, are there things beyond security? Here's why I'm asking, because the idea that you're going to legislate lean software into the world, as opposed to having it come from the bottom up, where people are recognizing the need because it's costing them something. So what are the costs, commercial costs, to bloated software?
Well, apparently absolutely none. And that really is the issue. Like, really none, because, you know, software often isn't maintained. People just really want to get their products out. They want to move very quickly. We see this when it comes to, you know, they like to abandon old software very quickly. We see, some companies like to abandon old products as soon as the new one comes out. There really is no commercial downside to using this big software, because you can always say, well, it's industry standard. Everybody is doing it. Because everybody is doing it, you're not necessarily losing out to your competitor. We see these massive security breaches, and again, the legislating for lean software is through demanding better security, because currently we see these huge security breaches and there's really very minimal consequences. Occasionally, yes, you see a company screws up so badly that it goes down, but even so, you see sometimes they'll reemerge in a different form, or they get gobbled up and so on. There really does not at the moment seem to be any commercial downside for this for this big software in the same way that there are a lot of like weird incentives in the system, and this certainly is one of them where actually the incentive is just use all the frameworks, bolt everything together, use JS Electron, use all the libraries, doesn't matter, because the end user is not really going to notice very much if their program is 10 megabytes versus 350 megabytes, especially now when people are completely immune to the size of their software. Back in the days when, you know, software came with floppy disk, if you had a piece of software that came on 100 floppy disks, that would be considered impractical. But nowadays, people are downloading, you know, people are downloading gigabytes of data just to watch, you know, to watch a movie or stuff like this. If a program is 1 gigabyte versus 100 megabytes, they don't really notice. I mean, the only people who notice is if, say, a video game's a really big video game. And then you see people going, well, you know, it took me, you know, 3 hours to download the 70 gigabytes for this AAA game that I wanted to play. That's about the only time you see people complaining about the size of software, the actual storage size of software anymore. But everybody else, they just don't care. It's just invisible to them now.
And, you know, that's a good thing. I think Charles Troy had a piece for us on we'll have endless storage. Right. On disks, apparently.
I love this story, because it's a story, it's another story of a technology that it's kind of like looks like it's headed off into the sunset and we'll see you in the museum. And this is optical disc technology. I love this story because the idea that you can, you know, optical discs, we had laser discs, we had CDs, we had CD-ROMs, we had DVD, we had Blu-ray. And Blu-ray really seemed to be kind of, many ways, the end of the line for optical discs. That after that, we're just going to use solid-state storage devices, and we'll have, we'll store all our data in those tiny little memory cells. And now we have these researchers coming back, and now my brain has frozen for a second on where they're from. I think they're from Shanghai. Is this Shanghai Institute?
Yes,
Shanghai. There we go. Very nice, subtle check of the website there. But and it might let us squeeze this data center to somebody outside of the room. And this is this optical disc technology where you can make a disc that's about the size of just a regular DVD, and you can squeeze just enormous amount of data. I think he's talking about petabits.
Like 1.6 petabits.
Petabits in on this optical surface, and the magic key is, as always, a new material. I mean, we do love new materials because they're always the wellspring from which so much springs. And we have, I'd say, we have at Spectrum many times chased down materials that have not fulfill necessarily their promise. We have a long history, and then sometimes materials go away and they come back like
graphene.
Graphene and stuff like this. We're always looking for the new magic material. But this new magic material allows you, which has this complicated
I looked this one up. What is it?
It is called?
Actually, our story did not even bother to include the translation because it's so botched. But it is AIE-DDPR IDIPR, right. Or aggregation induced emission didoped photoresist.
Okay, so well, let's just call it a magic new diode photoresist. And the point about this is that this material works at basically four wavelengths. And why you want a material that responds at four different wavelengths? Because the limit on optical technologies, by optical I'm also stretching here into the boundaries on either side of optical. You know, the standard rule is you can't really do anything that's smaller than the wavelength of the light you're using to read or write. So the length of your laser sets the density of data on your disk. And what these clever clogs have done is they've worked out by using basically two lasers at once. You can, in a very clever way, write a blob that is smaller than the wavelength of light. And you can do it in multiple layers. So use your standard Blu-ray disc, or say, you know, they're very limited in the number of layers they have on them, like CDs originally. One layer, you know, and then we get, so you have multiple layers on this disk that you can write to, and you can write it at resolutions that you wouldn't think you could do if you were just doing, you know, your, from your high school physics or whatever. And then you, so you write it using these two lasers of two wavelengths, and then you read it back using another two lasers at two different wavelengths, and this all localizes and makes it work. And suddenly, you, as I say, you can squeeze this enormous, you know, racks and racks and racks of solid state storage down to hopefully something that is very small. And they actually say what's also interesting is that they're actually closer to commercialization than you normally see with these early material stories. And they also think you could write one of these disks in 6 minutes, which is pretty impressive. As someone who stood and has sat watching the progress bars on a lot of, you know, DVD ROMs burn over the years back in the day, you know, 6 minutes to burn these, that's probably for commercial mass production, is still pretty impressive. And so you could solve this problem of some of these large data transfers we get, where currently you do have to ship servers from one side of the world to the other because it actually is too slow to copy things over the internet. And so this would increase the bandwidth of sort of the global sneaker net or station wagon net quite dramatically as well.
Yeah, you know, they are super interested in using them, in seeing them deployed in big data centers. And in order for them to do that, they still have to get the writing speed up the energy consumption down. So the real engineering is just beginning for this. Well, speaking of new materials, there's a new use for aluminum nitride, according to our colleague Glenn Zorpet, who wrote about the use of the material in power transistors. And apparently, if you properly dope this material, it'll have a much higher band, wider band gap, and be able to handle higher voltages. So what does this mean for the grid, Stephen?
Yeah, so I actually find power electronics really fascinating, because most of the history of transistors, right, is about making them use ever smaller amounts of electricity. You know, 5-volt logic used to be pretty common, now 3.3 is pretty common, and even 1.1 volts is pretty common, and really sipping, you know, milliamps, microamps of power through these circuits. And power electronics kind of get you back to actually kind of the origins of you know, being electronics engineer, electrical engineers, which is when you're really talking about power and energy, and you are humping around thousands of volts and you're running around huge currents. And power electronics is an attempt to bring some of that smartness that transistors gives you into these much, much higher voltages. And, you know, we've seen some of this with, say, gallium nitride, which is a material we had talked about in Spectrum for years, speaking materials that have been for years, floating around, not really finding it. And then really, though, in the last like 5 years, you've seen it be a real commercial success. So all those wall warts we have, you know, have gotten dramatically smaller and better, you know, which is why you can have like a USB-C charger system where you can drive your laptop and bunch of ancillary peripherals all off one little wall wart without worrying about it like bringing down the house, because it's just so efficient and so small. And most of those now are these new gallium nitride based devices, which is one example where a material really is making some progress. And so aluminium nitride is kind of another step along that, to be able to handle even higher voltages, being able to handle bigger currents. So we're not up yet to the level where you could, you know, have these shunt, you know, massive high voltage transmission lines directly. But the more and more you invent that, the sort of the rising tide of where you can put these kind of electronics into your systems. First off, it means more efficient. As I say, these wall wart chargers, these power adapters that convert AC to DC, they get more efficient. Your power supplies in your computer get more efficient than your power supplies in your grid center. We've talked about how much power grid centers take get more efficient. And it bundles up. And the whole point of this is that you do want a grid that is smart as possible. You need something that will be able to handle very intermittent power sources, fluctuating power sources. The current grid is really built around very, very stable power supplies, that, you know, very constant power supplies, very stable frequency timings. So the frequency of the grid is the key to stability. Everything's got to be on that 60 hertz in the US, 50 hertz in the other places. Every power station's got to be synchronized very precisely with the other. So like stability is a problem. Being able to handle fluctuations quickly is the key to both grid stability and to be able to handle some of these intermittent sources where the power varies as the wind blow stronger or weaker, as the day turns, as clouds move in front of your farm. So it's very exciting from that point of view to see these very esoteric technologies. We're talking about these like things like band gaps and putting, how do you stick the right doping molecule in the matrix? But it does bubble up into these like very large, large scale impacts from when we're talking about the future of electrical engineering and that old school power and energy, keeping the lights on and the motors turning kind of a way.
Right. And the electrification of everything is just going to put bigger demands on the grid, like you were saying, for alternative energy sources. They're all price competitive now, the solar and wind.
Not just at the generate, like that, this idea that you have distributed power and power can be generated locally. So and also right. Being able to switch power. So you have these smart transformers so that if you are generating surplus power on your solar panels, you can send that to maybe your neighbor next door who's charging their electric vehicle without it all having to be mediated by going up to the power company. Maybe your local transformer is making some of these local grid scale balancing decisions that are much closer to where the power is being used.
Oh, yeah. Stephen, that reminds me of this other piece we had this week, actually, on utilities and profit motive on their part hampering U.S. grid expansion. It's by a Harvard scholar named Ari Pesco. Mm-hmm. And his first line is, "The United States is not building enough transmission lines to connect regional power networks. The deficit is driving up electricity prices, reducing grid reliability, and hobbling renewable energy deployment." And basically, yeah. They're just saying that it's not what he does a good job explaining is not only how these new projects might impact their bottom lines, but also all of the industry alliances that they've established over the years that become these embedded interests that need to be disrupted.
Yeah, the truth is there is a list of things we could do, not they're not magic things. They're pretty obvious things we could do that would make the U.S. grid, even if you don't care much about renewables, you probably do care about grid resilience and reliability and being able to move power around. The U.S. grid is not great. It is creaky. We know there are things that could be done. As a byproduct of doing those things, you also would actually make it much more renewable friendly. And so it is this issue of like there are political problems. Depending on which administration is in power, there's more or less an appetite to deal with some of these interests. And then you just have straight up these utilities have incentives to kind of keep things the way they are. They don't necessarily want a grid where it's easier to get cheaper electricity from one place or more green electricity from one place to a different market. Everybody loves a captive monopoly market that they can sell. I mean, that's wonderful if you could do that. And then there are many places that are anti-competition rules, but grids are it's really difficult to break down those barriers.
It is. And if you're in Texas in a bad winter and the grid goes down and you need power from outside, but you're an island unto yourself and you can't import that power, like it becomes like something that is disruptive to people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like people pay attention to it during a disaster, but we have a slow rolling disaster called climate change that if we don't start overturning some of the barriers to electrification and alternative energy sources, stealing our own grave.
It is very tricky because we do then get at these issues where you're building these transmission lines, and it's kind of there are questions about who
ends up paying for those transmission lines, where they get built over their lands, the local impacts of those. And it's hard sometimes to tell. Is this somebody who, is this a group that is really genuinely feeling that there is a sort of justice gap here, that they're being asked to pay for the sins of, you know, higher carbon producers, or is this astroturfing? And sometimes it's very difficult to tell, and, you know, and that these organizations are being underwritten by people who are invested in the status quo. And it does become a knotty problem. And we are going to, I think, as things get more and more difficult, be really faced into making some difficult choices. And I am not quite sure how that's going to play out, but I do know that we will, you know, keep tracking it as best we can. And I think maybe, you just have to come back and see how we keep covering the grid in Pages of Spectrum.
Excellent. Well.
And so that's probably a good point where I think we're going to have to wrap this round up here. But thank you so much for coming on the show.
Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. Much fun.
So today on Facing the Future, I was talking with Spectrum's editor-in-chief, Harry Goldstein, and we talked about electric vehicles, we talked about software bloat, and we talked about new materials. I'm Stephen Cass, and I hope you join us next time.